An incident which is perhaps one of the most widely publicized and well-known close encounter cases involved Betty Hill and her late husband Barney. The Hill case has become a classic example of alleged extraterrestrial contact with human beings because it contains elements which are still the subject of heated debate among UFO investigators all over the world. On the 19th of September, 1961, as Betty and Barney Hill were driving in the White Mountains of New Hampshire, they saw a distant point of light which seemed to move erratically. As it moved closer, the light became more intense, Betty Hill remembers.
When we reached what is called the Indian Head area, this craft left the top of the mountain, came out of the highway, and stopped in mid-air. Barney took the binoculars and started out of the car in an attempt to identify the craft. And as he did this, he saw a group of figures standing in the windows looking down at him. One was saying to him, "Don't be afraid, keep looking, stay there. Don't be afraid, no harm's going to come to you, but stay there." And the craft started to descend. And Barney ran back to the car, saying we had to get out of there, they were going to capture us. And we took off speeding down the highway. There was a series of beeping sounds.
That was all the Hills could remember about the incident when they finally arrived home, but they both had an uneasy feeling that there was something more. Months passed, but life was not the same for the Hills. Barney suffered recurring headaches. They were tense, upset, couldn't sleep. Finally, they took their troubles to a Boston psychiatrist, Benjamin Simon, who used hypnotic regression to discover the root cause of their distress.
We relived where the ones on the craft were now on the ground, blocking so we couldn't drive. Barney put on the brakes, the car motor died. They separated, came up on each side, took us out, took us in a path through the woods, took us on board, gave us physical examinations. We were being kidnapped.
Betty Hill remembers being able to offer a detailed description of her alien abductors.
They're all shot. The leader, I would say, was my height, or just a little taller than I am, and I'm 5 foot. They all had dark uniforms. I shouldn't say uniform. All had a one-piece dark clothing on. And some were wearing jackets, and some were wearing caps, others were not. They were bald, no hair, no eyebrows, no eyelashes, and no earlobes, no ear, you know, that we could see. Very large eyes, very small, flat nose, thin slit for mouth.
Dr. Simon was astounded by Betty's hypnotic recall of the alleged abduction, mainly because Barney told him essentially the same incredible story in a separate hypnotic interview. Simon felt the possibility of a hoax was remote. The Hills had obviously undergone a traumatic experience, but was it real or an illusion? Betty Hill describes her experience aboard the craft.
I was shown a star map. When he showed me the map, he said, "Do you know where you are on the map?" And I said, "No, I don't." So I assume he meant our sun and planets. He also said the heavy lines on the map were places they went all the time. The lighter lines were places they went occasionally or frequently. The broken lines were expeditions. And of course, our own sun system was a place where they go frequently or occasionally.
Through a post-hypnotic suggestion, Betty reproduced the star map. Years later, an Ohio school teacher, Marjorie Fish, saw the map and began a tedious attempt to verify its accuracy.
Since the map was apparently drawn from the vantage point of the ufonauts and not from Earth, it had to be checked out by way of a model rather than using just our sky maps. And so I started to get information on how to build and started building models of the nearby star systems. I built about 22 models in all. When Betty claims to have seen the map, it was 1961. When she drew the map, it was 1964. The original data I worked with were catalogs from 1963 and 1964, and I was not able to find the whole pattern. I did get a large part of the pattern, but I couldn't fit in the last three that had lines to or any of the background stars. And when the 1969 Gliese catalog came out, then the last three stars fell into place, plus the background stars. And Betty could not possibly have drawn that map from anything that she had seen or could have used at the time that she drew the map as a hoax. Also, she doesn't have the astronomy knowledge to do so. And again, it could not have been a hoax by anyone else on Earth at that time.
According to Betty Hill's map, the lines representing what she called trade routes converged on a pair of stars known as Zeta 1 and Zeta 2 Reticuli. They are barely visible to the naked eye, and those living in the northern hemisphere can't see them at all. Their estimated distance from Earth is just over 37 light years. Stanton Friedman, physicist and noted UFO lecturer, says that according to Einstein's theory of relativity, 37 light years would be much shorter for those traveling aboard a craft than for those left behind.
What Einstein really said is not only that things can't go faster than the speed of light, and he put it in a much more technical fashion than that, but that as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time slows down for the things moving that fast. So that, for example, at 99.9% of the speed of light, you could go a 37 light year distance, forgetting the acceleration time for a moment, in 20 months pilot time. Now, if you really crank up the engine, put her in sixth gear or something, and go 99.99% of the speed of light, it would only take 6 months pilot time for a one-way trip of a distance of 37 light years. It's mind-boggling, sure, but it's real.
Betty Hill's star map is probably the most convincing evidence of alien visitors to Earth thus far. Dr. Hynek summarizes the Hill case.
Now, what many commentators seem to have missed in this star map situation, and which makes the case truly unique, is that the lines connecting certain stars that were drawn by Betty Hill, who by her own admission knew little of astronomy, just happened to connect only those stars that, like the Sun, are capable of supporting life on a nearby planet. The odds against this happening purely by chance are staggering, especially when one considers that of the 1,000 stars in the solar neighborhood, only 48 fall into this category.
Finally, the Air Force has confirmed that a UFO was tracked on radar in the vicinity of New Hampshire's White Mountains on the night of the Hill's abduction. One of the most perplexing questions which remains unanswered is whether the American government knows more about the UFO phenomenon than it's telling. Former CIA employee Brad Ayers, now with the Center for UFO Studies, thinks the immense bureaucratic machinery is making it nearly impossible for the public to find out.
I've found, although I've listened to hundreds of stories and a lot of allegations, I've found no hard evidence that the government is deliberately repressing information about UFOs. I think that a lot of what is attributed to a repression of information or the suppression of information is reduced to just simple bureaucratic ineptness and red tape.
What about the possibility that there is indeed physical evidence of extraterrestrial visitations to Earth, perhaps locked away in the dark vaults of government secrecy? Astronaut Gordon Cooper is among several authorities who are unwilling to dismiss the theory as pure fiction. Cooper himself has heard rumors of crashed saucers recovered by the military.
There was some accident involving a UFO, and there, from there it varies greatly. There were occupants in each of the rumors that I've heard, but from there on it varies greatly as to whether they were all alive or some alive, or what the extent of damage was to them, and then as to what happened to them is quite variable. The particular rumors aren't necessarily from people who've been involved, but they come from so many different sources that it would lead you to believe that it certainly is worth investigating a little further. My personal feeling all along has been that I feel that the government should be honest with the citizens of the United States, and I think they really underestimate the intelligence level of the citizens of the country by continually hiding things from them.
Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Over the years, these rumors have persisted. Hardly a week goes by without my being asked about the crashed saucer stories. My response to these rumors has always been complete skepticism. Recently, however, some of my colleagues, investigative research associates, have probed into these stories, and some intriguing information has surfaced. I believe it is quite worthwhile to let listeners to this record have the benefit of some preliminary findings. In any event, a rather dramatic story has developed. It starts with the following affidavit of one Lieutenant Colonel Robert B. Willingham.
Down at Dice Air Force Base in Texas, we were testing what turned out to be the F-94s. They reported on the scope that they had an unidentified flying object flying at a high speed, going to intercept our course. It became visible to us, and we watched it, and we wanted to take after it, but the headquarters wouldn't let us go after it. And it played around a little bit, and we got to watching how it made 90-degree turns at this high speed and everything. We knew it wasn't a missile of any type.
Willingham's sighting occurred late in 1948, but he remained silent about the experience for nearly 30 years, deciding only recently to forsake an oath of secrecy in the public interest for this investigation. When the incident took place, the UFO was originally tracked by a chain of radar stations along the Arctic Circle called the Dew Line, part of North America's air defense system.
So then we conferred it with the radar control station on the Dew Line, and they kept following it, and they claimed that it crashed somewhere down off in the between Texas and old Mexico border. And we got a light aircraft, me and my co-pilot, and we went down to the site, and we landed out in the pasture right across from where it hit at. So we got over there, they told us to leave and everything else, and then the armed guards come out, and they started forming a line around the area. So on the way back, I seen a little piece of metal, so I picked it up and brought it back with me. There were two sand mounds that came down, and it looked to me like this thing crashed right in between them. But it went into the ground, according to the way the people were acting around it. So we actually never did get right up to the site to see what had crashed. But you could see for, oh, I'd say probably 300 to 500 feet where it had went across the sand, like in there. And it looked to me like, I guess, from the metal that we found, chunks of metal, that it either had a little explosion or it began to disintegrate or something caused this metal to come apart, you know.
After they had left the crash site, Willingham and his co-pilot examined the piece of metal and found it to possess unusual qualities.
It looked like it was something made because it was honeycombed. You know how you make metal for where it will cool faster? In a way, it looked like a magnesium steel, but it had a lot of carbon in it because I tried to heat it with a cutting torch and it just wouldn't melt. A cutting torch with acetylene and oxygen burns at anywhere from 32 to 3800 degrees Fahrenheit. And it would make the metal hot, but it wouldn't even start to make it yield.
Willingham took the material to a Marine Corps metallurgy lab in Hagerstown, Maryland, for analysis. Several days later, he was told that the man he had contacted there had never worked for the lab and that no one else there knew anything about the piece of metal. Willingham adds this postscript.
Well, at that time, all unidentified flying objects, anybody that reported one through the Air Force, had to be debriefed on it. Even the radar operators were debriefed on what they had followed on the screen. We were not to even discuss it among the pilots that had seen it, that had been on this mission. We weren't even discussing it among ourselves. We signed papers that we would not discuss it with nobody.
Investigative Research Associates, with the help of former National Security Agency intelligence specialist Todd Zeckel, traced a former aide to an Army general who claimed to have been shown a crashed saucer, which was reportedly being stored and studied at a Virginia military installation in the mid-1960s. Herbert Coyer was a student at a southern university where the one-time general's aide is currently employed. Coyer remembers the incredible account related to him by the former aide in front of two other witnesses who have both confirmed that the conversation did indeed take place.
The story began with a crash of a flying saucer, a small vessel approximately 12 to 13 feet across, in White Sands Proving Ground in New Mexico in 1951. Outside of the vessel, I found one small being in a spacesuit of sorts, approximately 3 to 3.5 feet tall. It was humanoid. The only main difference between them and us, aside from size, was larger eyes. The eyes were noticeably larger. They followed two sets of tracks approximately a mile beyond the ship and found two more beings, also dead. These were taken to Langley Field in Virginia. He toured Langley, and as part of this tour, they were shown this vessel, one other ship of the same size. They saw the three beings, one of which they had performed an autopsy on, and internally he said they were basically the same as human beings inside. It seems to stick in my mind that one of them was preserved. The vessel had a 1 foot discrepancy between the inner and outer wall that they could not account for. There were no moving parts, no controls of any kind inside the ship, just chairs back to back. And that was it. No means of control, no means of power they could find. And as of the time I heard the story, they had not been able to cut in any way the surface of the ship either.
That astounding story, told to Coyer by the general's aide, remains unproven. But each conversation we had with the aide and other individuals allegedly involved directly with crash saucers had one common denominator, as Dr. Hynek explains.
During the many conversations all of us had with the military officers said to have been involved in some way with the crashed saucer incident, they never directly confirmed their stories. But more significantly, each individual also refused to deny his involvement, even after having been given numerous opportunities to do so. Why couldn't they have gotten us off their backs simply by saying the rumors were not true? This they would not do, leading me to believe that these people are indeed fearful to speak candidly about their experiences, whatever they might have been.
Crashed extraterrestrial spacecraft on Earth, recovered by American military officials, and currently in storage somewhere in the United States. Truth or fantasy? President Carter had this to say about the issue of public access to UFO information during the 1976 presidential campaign.
I don't see any reason to keep information like that secret, but there may be some aspects of the UFO information that, with which I'm not familiar, that might be related to some secret experiments that we were doing that might involve our national security or new weapon systems. I certainly wouldn't release that. But if it was something removed from our national security, you know, in my opinion as president, I would go ahead and release it. I see nothing wrong with that.
Meanwhile, Investigative Research Associates and the Center for UFO Studies will continue to seek the final answer and would welcome any new information which will be held in the strictest confidence. You have now heard the evidence. The witnesses have stated their cases. Now, the experts draw their conclusions. Stanton Friedman represents one point of view.
I'm convinced that the evidence is overwhelming that planet Earth is being visited by intelligently controlled vehicles from off the Earth. In other words, that some UFOs are somebody else's spacecraft. Let's face it, we've only had technology for a lousy 100 years. What if somebody got started just a tiny bit before we did on his technological kick? I mean, what the heck? We've increased our top speed for moving people around 1,000 times over what we could do just 100 years ago. We live in a system that's 5 billion years old. Our solar system. So if a guy gets started just a tiny bit, what's that, 100 years? He could be 1,000 times faster than we are, using techniques about which we know nothing.
Many experts feel that there is too little evidence to warrant jumping to that conclusion. Dr. Hynek explains one alternative theory that we might be dealing with something from another dimension.
One of the most intriguing aspects of UFO sightings is their apparent isolation in space and time. Sightings are usually made in one place at a time and last for short periods, sometimes appearing out of nowhere and vanishing into nowhere. This is much more suggestive of a parallel reality than, let's say, visits from some faraway planet, in which case we might expect them to stick around for a while.
And there are those who say the phenomenon is a product of fertile imaginations. UFO researcher Dr. Jacques Vallée sees a great danger if governments and scientists continue to dismiss it in this manner.
I'm afraid of the credibility gap of science with respect to this phenomenon, because you have millions of people who, rightly or wrongly, believe they've seen UFOs, you're talking about thousands of people to whom the phenomenon has become personally important in their lives. And these people have nobody to talk to. They can't talk to the military, they can't talk to the police, they can't talk to scientists. Nobody will look at that kind of data. And I think that we as scientists have a responsibility to those people.
Computer science is being used to separate fact from fiction in dealing with UFO reports. Dr. David Saunders, with the help of the Center for UFO Studies, heads up Project UFOCAT, a computerized system which processes and analyzes the thousands of UFO sightings reported each year.
It turns out that certain areas produce more and certain areas produce fewer. You start to ask why, and you uncover the fact that the areas producing more than their share are better educated, which comes as a surprise to some people. And after that, you might uncover the fact that an area in which there is better visibility, seeing conditions, produces more than its share, which comes as a surprise if you don't think there's anything to it.
Once again, Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
The idea of other intelligences in space is not so radical or new. It's in both the ancient Eastern religions and the more modern faiths. The prophets in the Bible and many philosophers have been telling us for centuries that there are other planes of existence. So why do we find it so difficult to acknowledge that there might be other highly developed life forms or forms of consciousness that might surpass our own? In fact, it is now widely accepted that the universe may well be teeming with life.
The National Aeronautics and Space Administration has shown great reluctance to enter the arena of UFO investigating. And yet, ironically, NASA saw fit to include an unusual and significant recording aboard the Voyager 1 and 2 exploratory probes on their intergalactic missions to Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond. The introduction to the two-hour recording is by Kurt Waldheim.
As the Secretary General of the United Nations, an organization of 147 member states who represent almost all of the human inhabitants of the planet Earth, I send greetings on behalf of the people of our planet. We step out of our solar system into the universe seeking only peace and friendship, to teach if we are called upon, to be taught if we are fortunate. We know full well that our planet and all its inhabitants are but a small part of this immense universe that surrounds us, and it is with humility and hope that we take this step.